It's extraordinary when you think about it. So what we're saying here is that if you just don't put yourself on the lobbyist register because you don't see yourself as a third-party lobbyist.
You imagine yourself as a unicorn, for example, rather than a lobbyist. You know, I don't know.
I mean, we have no idea who these people are. We don't know who they're meeting with. The rules governing lobbying just don't apply to them. It's just this huge, huge failing.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. Today, we're going to talk about the Transparency Project, which is a series about lobbying and influence that's being spearheaded by my wonderful colleague, Chris Norse, also known affectionately in-house as the House of Nouse. This is very important work, and I thought it would be good to bring Chris into the pod cave and he can flesh it all out with me. So welcome, Chris.
Hello.
Now, you've been looking at this area for quite a while, and I've been preoccupied, obviously, by somewhat seismic events in my neck of the woods, so I haven't...
Very understandable.
Well, no, but we need to get on to what you've been doing. So take me through what you've found.
Well, look, I mean, we kind of went on into this project, I suppose, with three broad aims. One, we wanted to try and get a handle on this kind of nebulous concept of the revolving door and just how prevalent it is in Australian politics.
Why does it matter, the revolving door?
When we're talking about the revolving door, we're trying to, I guess, identify people who still maintain excessive influence or access. Look at who they're now working for, which private interests are paying them to try and influence policy or decisions, and try and work out whether that influence has been undue, whether they're having too much of an effect on the policy making process, and whether it's distorting things, I suppose. And to do that, we sort of looked at the roughly 500 lobbyists that are registered at a federal level, to see where they've come from, what their background is, whether they've had a history in government, a recent history in government. And one of the really key things that we found was that 52% of the 483 lobbyists have previously worked in government.
Mm-hmm.
And something like one in four had previously staffed the offices of ministers or parliamentary secretaries, backbenchers. So, you know, we're talking about people who have, I guess, connections within government, who have a good knowledge of how government works and in some cases still maintain fairly good access to
extensive networks and all of that stuff. Well, it's sort of at its simplest level, isn't it? It's whether there's one rule for one group of people and then another rule for another group of people. It's sort of, we see this in many different manifestations in politics, don't we, right? Where there is this perception, fair or unfair, out in the community, that people with connections get a certain quality of democracy and people without connections get another quality of democracy. So what you've discovered, in essence, is that there is that in the political process, it sort of self-perpetuates, power self-perpetuates, right? Is that fair, in the sense that people who were once inside offices, both politicians and staffers, then move outside the office, working for corporates or for other interests, and lobby the people they used to work for, in essence.
Right. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And if you think about it just in a really basic level, you know, it's almost human nature to, you know, think about arguments or receive arguments in a more favourable way from someone you know, from someone who you've had a history with, you've got a relationship with. You're much more likely to be receptive to what they're saying, to think about it positively. So just at that very basic human level, having those connections and using those connections on behalf of a private interest, you know, it can have a significant effect, I think.
Mm. And what did you learn about the system? Because you've given me a great stat there, right? That, you know, that nearly half of them basically are from from people inside the political system are now working outside the system lobbying it. But what did you discover about the system of regulation as it stands? Is it adequate or not? What, like, you know, what, how does the system work for people who have got no idea how a lobbying register works?
Let's get to that, right? Yeah, so, I mean, just as a really basic description, at a federal level, you've got two main things. You've got a code of conduct, which is basically a set of rules that aren't legislated in any way, but that they exist nonetheless, that are designed to govern behaviour of lobbyists. It sort of upholds ethical standards and sort of manages the way that they can approach government. And then you've also got, as part of that, a register, which is a publicly available list of all the third-party lobbyists, and those are lobbyists who work for want of a better word, professional lobbying firms, and are then engaged by a third party. And so that register lists all of those individuals, and it tells us a few things. It tells us who their clients are and who the individual lobbyists are working for any particular firm. That's about it. So that's the basic framework at a federal level. You know, states and territories that all have their own sort of individual systems, which are a mess, and I won't go into this at this, sure. at this particular juncture.
Poor Chris. Let's take pity on him. Yes. No, but, yes. But on that point, though, I thought, now I don't know because I've not looked at this closely, but I thought, and I'm not suggesting that any particular regulatory system for lobbyists in Australia works particularly well, right? And we can probably get into why it doesn't in a bit. But I thought, at least in some state jurisdictions, for example, the registers required the recording of contacts.
No, you're exactly right. So there's two jurisdictions that have gone some way in trying to monitor the contact between a lobbyist and government. In the ACT, lobbyists are required to file a quarterly report which details who they've lobbied and on what subject. You know, there's no real enforcement of that, and from my sort of looking through those documents, you know, they don't seem
doesn't
to
really
say
tell you much.
They don't seem
right.
to say a lot. Yeah, in New South Wales, they've approached it from the other end. So ministers are now required to publish their diaries. So you can have a sort of a fair estimation of who they've met with and at what point, and, you know, some scant detail about what they've talked about. At a federal level, all this just does not exist in any way. You can't even tell which individual lobbyist within a firm is lobbying for which company. So, you know, let alone, you know, when they've lobbied, when they might have met with ministers, what they're lobbying about, whether there's a particular policy they're trying to influence. None of that is available on a federal level. So, I mean, when this register was introduced back in 2008 by John Faulkner, much to the chagrin of the industry and to the rest of Parliament, really, it was a huge step forward. You know, before that, there was nothing, absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what we're left with is basically just a tiny glimpse into the world of lobbying and very little else.
We've been talking about third-party lobbyists, so professional lobbyists, people who lobby for a living, right? But also the other thing that's not captured, at least by the federal system, at least last time I looked at it, which is a long time, is in-house lobbyists, government relations people, for example, that work for massive corporations who are, I know from experience, in and out of this building all the time. So they're not covered. I don't think the industry associations are required to register as lobbyists, even though industry associations clearly do lobby on the part of their members, for example. Is that still the case, or have things moved on?
No, that's absolutely right. And it's extraordinary when you think about it. So what we're saying here is that if you just don't put yourself on the lobbyist register because you don't see yourself as a third-party lobbyist.
You imagine yourself as a unicorn, for example, rather than a lobbyist. You know, I don't know.
I mean, we have no idea who these people are. We don't know who they're meeting with, about what. You know, there's the codes, the rules governing lobbying just don't apply to them. It's just this huge, huge failing. So, I mean, there's people. And this is all very well reported. There's people like former Resources Minister Martin Ferguson, who works with APIO, the oil and gas peak body. He's not classified as a lobbyist. Stephen Conroy, the former Labor Minister, who works for Responsible Wagering Australia, a sort of peak group for online gambling companies. He's not classified as a lobbyist. And it's vast. I mean, we're talking about really big corporations, anyone they employ directly as a government relations person who may be, you know, week in, week out in Parliament talking to ministers about policy and decision making. These people just aren't classified as lobbyists. So it's a huge failing. Victoria's tried to do something about this to kind of really not great effect. They've introduced a register of government relations professionals. So if you're, say, a public affairs officer or a government relations person for, you know, a huge company, let's just say BHP as an example, you have to put yourself on that register if you plan to lobby a Victorian minister on behalf mm-hmm. of your company. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see from, I've been through that register, it's about 3 pages long. There's just no way people are putting themselves on that register as they're supposed to. It would be just a vast document if they were.
Mm.
The question that's always on my mind is and not being in Canberra, it's hard, I suppose, for me to get a handle on it, but it's really just how much effect do lobbyists have on politicians. There's been, I think I saw a piece from Mark Texter, a very well-known sort of pollster and lobbyist, who basically wrote in Fairfax some years ago that lobbyists, third-party lobbyists, are really quite ineffective. It's all a bit of a show, and they don't actually have that much influence over politicians at all. And I'd be keen to hear your thoughts on that, Murph.
Well, I think it's certainly you know, it's part of the culture of the building and has been as long as I've been in the building, that lobbyists are in and out of the place, and the best of them are connected. The best of them do know what's going on broadly, have got courtesy of their own professional backgrounds, you know, former staffers, a lot of them. They have a sort of not only a kind of actual tangible information by going in and out of offices, but they do have an intuitive sense of how the place runs and what is likely to happen on any given issue. So that's the best of them, right? But not everybody is in that category. I think it's interesting because one thing that has changed quite markedly over the time that I've been here is I think before the media cycle sped up for us and for politicians as well, so sort of pre-24/7 media cycle, there was much more time for everyone to chew the fat in the building. You know, it would be routine in the first 10 years of my reporting life in Canberra for me to go and have a cup of coffee with a couple of lobbyists whom I trusted. I trusted their expertise. I trusted their insight. And those contacts for me as a journalist were generally very valuable because I would have some information. They would have other information. Also, they could sort of, just trigger things that you hadn't thought of. Trigger other lines of inquiry that you hadn't thought of. Much less of that happens now, certainly, and that's a function of people not having time. And I know that's the case with journalists, that look, there's the same crowd of people who come through this whole show every sitting fortnight who want to have appointments with politicians, who want to speak to journalists. And of course that still continues. I'm not suggesting it doesn't continue. Of course it still continues. But I think there's just more pressure in the system, less slack in the system, less time in the system. And I think that's got to have an impact. Now, I wouldn't sort of adopt the texter. I mean, the thing about Mark is that he can sort of adopt argumentative positions, well-founded, but argumentative positions. And by that I mean rhetorical positions, right? That, you know, that all of it has no value or they're not very influential. I wouldn't say that, but I would say that the tempo of politics and the tempo of, because of course lobbyists seek to influence media coverage as well as political decisions, because one feeds back on the other, I think there's less time than there was even a decade ago for lobbyists to have that sort of impact. So that's a sort of structural change in the system. But I think, you know, one thing we haven't sort of really addressed in this conversation, Chris, is why these companies feel like they need third-party lobbyists in order to navigate their way through the great aquarium of Parliament House, right? Why does a company, you know, because obviously chief executives and government relations people in major corporations are highly paid, highly powerful people. So why do they need these river guides in Canberra, or feel as though they do? I think that a number of companies don't, or because corporate people think very differently to politicians, and corporate people don't necessarily intuit how politicians will come at a problem or come at a problem that impacts their business. So they do feel like they need these door openers. And door openers, you know, there's a business in it, obviously, being able to open a door for a corporate player who finds politics sort of broadly fascinating but mostly incomprehensible. So lobbyists trade on that. They trade on that lack of knowledge. There's big money to be made, and the system sort of self-perpetuates. You know, what do lobbyists do? How do they sort of seek to influence things? Well, I'll give you a couple of examples, right? Lobbyists, you know, who are looking after particular agencies, and lobbyists will sometimes even look after government agencies, like the tax office, or, you know, it's like some of the energy agencies had lobbyists during the whole National Energy Guarantee debate. You know, obviously they seek to bridge the gap between political officers and the agencies, but they also, you know, they take journalists out to dinner with principals. It's all very convivial. You know, it's designed to try and get everybody's points of view across. Now, you know, is this terribly nefarious? Well, I'm sure some of it is. you know, is all of it? Probably not. You know, do they influence results? Well, it's the big question. Like in a 20-year reporting career in Canberra, I can't really tell you whether they influence things or not. I think they do, the best of them do, and at the margins. But, you know, politics is a big unhinged beast and does what politics does. So, but it's an area that in which we absolutely need to shine a light, because it's a club. It's a very poorly regulated club. It's an exclusive club, and it's not very well reported. So this is a very important project.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right there, but I'll just pick up on one of your points. You know, there's this tendency when we talk about lobbying to think about the biggest corporations, the most powerful corporations, you know, working behind the scenes nefariously to influence outcomes. But, you know, the reality of lobbying in many cases is very different. You've got, you know, veterans groups who hire lobbyists, you've got aged care workers who hire lobbyists, you've got, you know, community groups who just have no idea about how to engage with government, because it is, as you say, it's an unhinged beast, it's incredibly complex. And I mean, I, you know, personally, I would have no idea if I was a community group from, you know, a small country town trying to put my point across, of how to even go about getting engaged with government. So lobbyists, they play a really important role in any sort of healthy democracy. They represent a person's expertise and their point of view and convey it to government in a way that's sort of comprehensible. I think the danger is where it starts to have this, you know, create this imbalance in the democratic process, where you are getting more access because you have more money, can hire a better connected lobbyist who can more easily, you know, get into a minister's office and talk to them and influence them. I think that's the danger, and the solution to it is really, as you say, it's transparency. We just need to know how these people are working and what they're trying to influence and when. And I think that would allay a lot of people's fears, that it would open up the democratic process and make things much more transparent.
Well, give people confidence, exactly. Mm. Sounds like a good note to end on. Thank you so much to Chris for coming on the show this week. I really, really appreciate it. And I encourage all the listeners and the regular subscribers to tune in to Chris's Transparency Project, which is rolling out on Guardian Australia. It is really important work. Also, if you are concerned by what you're reading, concerned by the journalism that we're doing, I also encourage you to raise your voice. You have agency in a democratic system. Everybody has a local MP. If you don't like what you're reading, if it doesn't seem right to you, then it's only appropriate that you exercise your democratic agency, and that means getting in touch with parliamentarians with a view to building a constituency for change. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni for his marvellous production, which involves two podcasts this week, so there's some logistical complexity associated with that. Thank you. A reminder, if you like the listening, to subscribe, tell your friends, all of that bizzo. Anyway, we will be back next week.